You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome to Connect the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on this second Wednesday in Lent. We have now achieved an anniversary. Lent is now 1 week old. Only, I don't know, 15, 20 years to go? I'm not really sure. At any rate, we are here. We're here today with my good friend, Mr. Rod Bennett. Rod Bennett, close personal friends with both Ray Bradbury and Ray Harryhausen.
that overstates the case considerably, Mark.
Mentor to Forrest Ackerman.
Well, I'd have to be even older than I am to be that. So it's the other way around, really. So
all right. Yeah, and just an all-around swell guy. How you doing, Rod?
I'm doing very well. I've got a beautiful spring afternoon here in the Smoky Mountains, and it's a little early to say spring, I suppose, but it's about 65 and sunny, and not much in the way of allergies yet, which is the true sign of the coming of spring around here, but it is a nice day.
That's a good sign, you know? You want spring to come. I was shocked to realize that this Saturday night spring forward. We're already going to be on daylight savings time this Sunday.
Yeah, they've been extending those things for years. Pretty soon we'll go back to standard time for about a week before Christmas, and that'll be about it, I think.
Yeah. I was really quite surprised by that. So,
but that's a good sign that warmer weather's ahead. So,
well, it also means we're getting cheated out of an hour of sleep, so we'll all be groggy through Mass on Sunday morning. But we'll somehow
we will offer it up, Mark.
Yes, this suffering that I'm enduring. I ate a tuna fish sandwich today, which technically fulfills, you know, the penitential thing for Lent, but not a whole lot because I like tuna fish. You know, I mean, it's not tuna fish isn't tuna fish is like the I don't know. It's the lowest grade of seafood that there is for me. Other seafood is always like ooh la la, but tuna fish is just kind of, you know, your sandwich. But anyway, I had one of those today, and so that was tasty good. I'm going out to St. Monica's Parish, which is out on Mercer Island. Washington geography is weird because we have islands in the middle of our state. And one of them is Mercer Island, which is this big island that sits in the middle of Lake Washington, which is inland from Puget Sound, which is actual salt water. So anyway, Mercer Island is also affectionately known to Seattleites as Poverty Rock because it's where all the super rich people live. There are a couple of neighborhoods in Seattle where everybody's wealthy. All of Mercer Island is where everybody's wealthy. So anyway, their parish out there wanted me to come out and talk, so I'm going to come out there tonight. We'll be talking about making senses out of Scripture, which is always a fun thing to talk about.
Yeah, you're not going to take woe to you rich as your text, huh?
No, I figure other people can handle that one. That's not what they're hiring me to do. They wanted me to come out. Talk about the four senses of Scripture. I'm happy to come out and talk about Woe to You Rich. Actually, I'm writing a piece right now called Jesus Christ Finance and Investment Counselor. And it's kind of looking at all the counterintuitive stuff that Jesus says about money, and as well as taking a little look at the ways in which we continually labor to blunt the edge of what Jesus actually said.
Right.
So,
just about have to.
Yeah, you know. So, I mean, what Jesus in fact says is, blessed are you poor. In Luke's gospel, he doesn't say, blessed are the poor in spirit. He says, blessed are you poor.
Oh, yeah.
Period.
Oh, yeah.
And then he goes on and says, woe to you who are rich. And yes, woe means, actually, it means woe to you who are rich. And it's like, what is this guy, a Marxist, you know? But
well, there's a little equation that he uses over and over in the Gospels about when somebody is getting their good things now.
Right.
In other words, one of the reasons you don't stand up, for example, and get a reputation as a pious man by standing on the street corners and getting looked up to is because, right. Well, what Jesus says about that man is that he has his reward already.
Got his reward.
Whereas the poor man, the man who beats his breast and says, God, have mercy on me, a sinner, gets his reward later. And the, of course, and it's spelled out pretty clearly also in the Gospels that this is pretty shrewd business dealings, you know, because life is short and death is long.
Yeah.
And this is a repeated refrain all through the Gospels. It is a business transaction. You know,
he uses money.
Take guys off the here and now and make a long-term investment.
Exactly right.
You know, accept your good things later.
Yeah.
Like, Lazarus is going to.
And, he uses financial imagery.
Don't take your
all
good things
time.
Now.
He uses financial imagery all the time.
Right.
And one of the things that, the counsel that he gives is like all the stuff that they tell you not to do in like the investment things, right? So be sure nobody cheats you. It's a dog eat dog world, Rod. And make sure that nobody screws you out of your money. So be shrewd, right? And what's his counsel? Give to anybody who asks.
That's right.
I mean, that's what he says, right? Anybody comes up to you and asks you for something, just give it to them, right? And he's
give them twice as much as they ask for.
And if they come to you and they pull a gun on you, give them twice as much and help them carry it, right?
It's like,
you know, stuff like that. And he also says, you know, I mean, what are we always told? Be sure that you get a good return on your investment. Invest shrewdly so that you will get a good return. And Jesus' counsel is, you know, make absolutely sure that the people that you give to can never possibly repay you.
Right.
Yeah, so there's all this counterintuitive stuff. And you mentioned the rich man and Lazarus. I mean, one of the things that's interesting, it's a question that I don't recall people discussing very much. But it's the question of why exactly did Lazarus go to hell? Yeah, you're right. I always do that. Why did the rich man go to hell? The question is an interesting one because if you say, as almost everybody says, it's because he didn't give charity to Lazarus, that's not why the rich man went to hell. Because you don't go to hell for not giving charity. Because charity is something super added. It's not something that's owed. So if I'm on the bus next to you and you're sitting there reading a book and I got 10 bucks burning a hole in my pocket and I get up and get off the bus, I haven't sinned against you by not giving you that 10 bucks because I didn't owe that to you. But if I'm walking down the street and you're lying in a pool of blood and I walk past you, then I've sinned against you. Why? Because I owed you something. You have a right to your life. And if I don't help you when your life is in danger, I am cheating you out of something. And what the rich man didn't do was he did not give to Lazarus what belonged to Lazarus in justice. And that's a distinction that is almost completely lost on people now.
Right,
the distinction between charity, between giving what is not owed, that's charity, and giving what is owed. And so what John Chrysostom says, and he bangs away at this repeatedly, not to give to the poor man what he is owed in justice is to cheat him, because what you've got that you don't need is belongs to the poor man in justice. So you're the thief if you don't give to him. And so the rich man was a thief, as well as, by omission, a murderer, because he let Lazarus die in poverty. And that's something that most people don't think about, because they've got this notion that everything that I have is mine by rights. And anything that I give to anybody ever is me doing charity. And that's not always the case.
Right. The idea that you come into this world with rights, with obligations as well as rights.
Yeah, yeah.
We've gotten lost somewhere along that, along the way.
Yeah.
We put a lot of emphasis on, you know, the fact that we all have certain inalienable rights given to us by our Creator. But He gives more than just rights. He gives obligations, too.
Right.
And that's what we don't like, the idea that we owe somebody something. They come right into the world owing somebody something.
Right.
Not a popular idea.
Well, you know, of course, you came into the world owing your parents a tremendous debt, because
sure,
they're the reason you're here.
Right.
We will be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Rod Bennett, and we will be back on Connecting the Dots here on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hello, and welcome back to... I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. What I love about the internet is that the internet is always probing the new realms for tinier and tinier subgroups to be completely outraged about. So there's a headline in Slate today that says, "Why do recipe writers lie about how long it takes to caramelize onions?" Why, Rod? Where do you come down on this
secret
question?
Conspiracy, I guess.
Where do you come down on this question? Choose wisely.
On the burning issues of
you
the day.
You will have made an enemy for life. Yeah. So, you know, every once in a while, I'll be minding my own business, and I'll just walk into one of these discussions where, like, two camps have set up, you know, two households.
And your opinion is needed, Mark.
Yes. Two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona, where we lay our seed. And it's sir, do you bite your thumb at me? Is this thumb biting thing? Is this, like, something I need to care about? Yes.
Well, this is the siren song of the internet, is the idea that there's all these burning issues out there that we need your opinion about.
Right.
Somebody really cares and wants to know where you stand on this.
Yep.
Some of us eventually figure out that nobody really cares where we stand on this. Sure. But there's a forum to communicate it if you should so desire.
Yep. It's just amazing. So there's so that is something to get upset about, is the length of time it takes to caramelize an onion.
My attitude is, I'm having trouble finding anything to get upset about these days.
Well, for me, of course, the longer the better, man, because there is no smell more wonderful than onions simmering in butter. It's just the greatest smell there is in the entire world. And it's so unlike just onion smell. That's the weird thing. I mean, it's just heavenly.
Well, but this is not a very Lenten thought, Mark.
Oh, you're right. Okay, I'm sorry.
But get thee behind me, Satan.
Onions. yes. Well, anyway, so before the break, we were talking about Jesus Christ's financial investment counselor. And it really is, it strikes me over and over again how counterintuitive Jesus is. And the kinds
well, it's more
of,
than that. I mean, he spells it out exactly what the whole principle is. Throw your life away.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, throw it away now because you believe what I'm telling you about the way to be rich long term.
Yeah.
In other words, prove to God that you believe this thing that you can't see with your eyes because I told you so.
Yeah.
And that is that you can safely throw this life away because the one that I'm offering to you lasts longer, much, much longer. That's a scary idea. You know?
Sure, yeah, it's a big bet. You know, I mean that's one of those things where we really are walking by faith and not by sight. And so, you know, one of the things that he'll do, the classic thing, you know, why do you get rich? You get rich so you can take it easy. I'm not going to have to work anymore because now I've got all this money to take care of me. You know, poor people are the ones who work like dogs all the time.
Right.
And what Jesus always tells the powerful is those to whom much is given, much will be required. Right. And so St. John Chrysostom, again, John Chrysostom's got a lot of great quotes. You know, he's the guy that said, if you cannot see Christ in the beggar at the church door, you will not find him in the chalice. And he also says, and I think this is one of the most profound summaries of almost everything Jesus has to say about money. John Chrysostom says that the rich exist for the poor, for the benefit of the poor. The poor exist, he says, for the salvation of the rich. And that really does summarize virtually everything that Jesus has to say about money.
Neither condition is an end in and of itself.
Right.
That's what we lose is that
people are for each other.
Yeah.
And the things that we have are for the benefit of people. So the church never, for example, absolutizes property rights. Your property is always, it's yours conditionally.
The overarching principle is you can never make anything in this world the end because
right.
It's all transitory. And
yeah,
you're not.
That's idolatry.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what Jesus does, for example, is he tells that really strange parable of the dishonest steward. That one used to just baffle me. It's still extremely mysterious. I understand it a little bit better now. But the point of that parable, you know, where you got the dishonest steward whose master is going to let him go. And so he says, well, I'm too weak to dig and I'm too proud to beg. What'll I do? I know what I'll do. So he calls in his master's debtors and says, what's the bill you owe my master? And the guy goes, well, 100 shekels. And so the dishonest steward says, well, take your bill and mark it down to 80 shekels. And he does the same thing with a bunch of other people. So what's he doing there? How does he get the right to just, you know, jack down the bill? Well, what he's doing there is he's taking off basically the service fee, or as we might call it today, the cream that he was going to charge for his own services. So I'm taking my fee out of the equation. So you only owe my master the 80 shekels you actually owed him and not the extra 20 shekels that I was going to take because, you know, because I'm a crook, right? And so and then the moral that Jesus draws from this is make friends, he says, with unrighteous mammon, so that later on they will welcome you into eternal habitations. What's the point here? The point is that Jesus is saying, he's turning the idea of patronage on its head. The idea of patronage is go find a rich guy and suck up to him. So if you're Leonardo da Vinci and you're looking for a job, go to the Medici's and tell them how awesome you are and ask them to pay your freight so that you can do paintings and design, you know, hovercrafts and, you know, whatever else it is that you do, armaments and all the cool things that you do. And that's how patronage works, is you go find a rich person and you suck up to them. Well, what Jesus is essentially saying is go find poor people and suck up to them. Because they're the ones whose prayers are going to get you into heaven. That's what eternal habitations means. And so make friends with the poor, says Jesus. They're your patrons. Yeah. They are the ones who are going to look out
and
for
once
you
again,
because
the,
their prayers are going to matter.
The recurring theme is do just exactly the opposite of what it seems like you should do.
Right, yeah. And he does this
because,
all the time.
Because
you know?
It's a mirror image. It's an inverse. Right. You know, it's strange. You know, one of the, I don't know how many people remember the science fiction movie, The Matrix. One of the things that most people thought was really Eastern religion in The Matrix is the scene where the strange little kid with the Buddha haircut bends the spoon with his mind, or seems to, at any rate.
Yeah, yeah.
And when our hero is amazed by it, he says, don't try to bend the spoon. He says, try to realize that there is no spoon.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds like Eastern mumbo-jumbo, but in the context of the story, it's absolutely right. In other words, the world that the hero inhabits at the moment is a simulation. He's
right.
Living inside a computer simulation.
Right.
And the temptation, the way he gets power is by realizing that he's in a simulation.
Right.
That all of the various threats and things that are being offered to him, you know, people trying to kill him and all the rest of it, get all of their power from the fact that he believes that the illusion is real, or can't stop believing that the illusion is real.
Right.
Now, the point I'm making here is that Christ does something very similar. He says, this world makes an immediate appeal to you right now. Every minute that you're here, it screams, take thought for tomorrow. You know, be careful. Don't just throw your money away on beggars and all that. This is what the world tells you.
Right.
He says, I'm telling you that the world is not permanent, that the things that matter, and your life is not long. So it doesn't matter if you don't have a nice house and all the other things, because it's all over in the blink of the eye anyway. But what does matter is what happens to you long term.
Yeah.
And so, you know, don't try to bend the spoon. Realize that there is no spoon.
Yeah.
In other words, don't put your focus on this world, because this world is passing away.
Yeah.
And if you will come out feeling like a fool the day after you die, because you made a lot of choices based on something that was never permanent, went away quickly, is completely a dead letter at this point, and yet you've got eternity yawning ahead of you. And so it's a very, very sobering message, but that's the message of Christ in a lot of ways. Act as if you believe what I'm telling you, that this world is kind of a matrix that's going away very quickly.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He's giving you inside information, you know.
And he's incredibly casual about stuff. You know, I mean, things that our whole, I mean, what does the U.S. economy and the entire U.S. government and the whole global economy center on? It's all about what will we eat, what will we wear, where will we live?
Right.
That's the whole thing, right? And he's like, nah, don't worry about that.
Right. I think it might be wise to step in and say he's not saying that there ought not to be government, and that the government ought not to be run wisely and fairly. He's addressing the individual soul.
Right, right.
He
exactly.
said, the question is, what must I do to be saved? And he gives you the answer. He's not really giving a program for building a government on.
We're up against the break, but we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots on Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. We were talking over the break. So today is the Day Without Women, which is basically a day where rich women who can afford to do it
sounds like
go to work.
The first 30 years of my life, Day Without Women.
Yes. Yes, until I was 25, every day was the Day Without Women. I get it. Sure. I had a lot more respect for the March for Women because it was, you know, anybody could go, and it was making clear that Trump is a swine and we're not going to put up with this. And I was all in favor of that. But, you know, the Day Without Women thing is basically a day when women who can afford to do it, so wealthy upper class women, don't go to work, to show the impact of women on the economy. Well, you know, only wealthy women can do that. Poor women can't do that because they'll get fired, because that's what it means to be poor and working some, you know, low wage job where your boss could say, there's 10,000 other people to take your job, so you're fired.
And you have to take your child that you'd rather be home raising off to a daycare for some other woman to raise.
Yeah,
so that the child cries when you come and pick it up in the evening because it's more attached to the daycare lady than it is to you.
Yeah. So these kinds of things don't speak to me very deeply. I mean, it's okay, fine. You know, it's something and it's an effort. My attitude toward opposition to Trump is all hands on deck. So, sure. You know, and Trump gave some statement about how I respect women, which... you know, it's sort of like, you know, Hannibal Lecter celebrating National Vegan Day. But, good for you, Donald Trump. You have convinced us all. But so there's that going on today. And, of course, there's the big thrill coming up, which I'm very, very excited about, which is the Kong movie, because I have a weakness for Kong movies, you know. You probably know one or two things about the original King Kong, I'm guessing. I'm just going way out on a limb here and saying you probably
know at least one or two things.
One or two things about the original King Kong, which is and remains one of just the all-time greatest movies ever made. There's just nothing like the original King Kong. I love that movie.
A lot of movies with the giant ape monster have come out through the years, but there's only one. King Kong.
Nothing like Kong, you know.
Let's put it this way. Only one of them is on the top 100 greatest films list with Citizen Kane and Casablanca.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the original 1933 King Kong.
What a terrific movie that is. It's just magical. Everything about that movie, you know, it's just, there's that moment where Carl Denham says to Ann Darrow, you know, it's the thrill of a lifetime and a long sea voyage. And everything in me goes, I want to go. I don't care if I get killed. I don't care if I get shaken off the log. I want to go on that voyage, you know.
Carl Denham is a kind of a fancy portrait of the producer of the film, a man named Marion C. Cooper, and you and I have talked about a little in the past. The story is really kind of a dressed-up version of a sort of love triangle that happened in real life. Cooper and his partner, Ernest Chodzak, they were documentary filmmakers in the silent movie days, where they actually did the kind of stuff that you see Denham doing in the movie, going out into jungles and places and making pictures of wild animals and getting charged by rhinos and all that kind of thing. And But they both fell in love with the same woman.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So, yeah, and so and that caused a falling out between the two of them for a while. And a lot of that dynamic is kind of what's going on in King Kong, the sort of love triangle between the hero, the lady, and the big subconscious id monster, in this case, okay. A giant ape, is interesting stuff.
That I really did not know that. I do know that the two pilots that shoot Kong down are Marion C. Cooper and Ernest Schoedsack.
That's exactly right, yeah.
So, yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, and their attitude was, well, we made this, you know, so-and-so. We should be the ones to kill him.
That's right. I just listened to earlier today a recording of a letter, I guess you would call it, on audio tape that was made back in the 60s where Schoedsack and his wife, Ruth Rose, who was the lady I mentioned a moment ago that they were both in love with. Uh-huh. She sent this first time I've ever heard her voice on this audio recording early today, and it's amazing how much she sounds like Faye Ray, or at least
really?
The way she sounds like her vocal mannerisms are like Faye Ray in the movie. So
isn't that interesting?
I wonder if Faye was aware of the fact that she was sort of standing in for the screenwriter in the menage a trois,
you know,
and that she sort of consciously imitated her.
One of the
like Forbidden Planet, King Kong is another one of those movies that you could just simply talk about for hours and hours and never get a lifetime and never get to the bottom of.
Yeah, it's so fun. You know, one of the things that I was gonna tell you an interesting factoid about. Oh, I know what it is. so the King Kong. And I think that this, you know, in some small way, perhaps redeems the man. King Kong was the favorite film of Adolf Hitler.
That's right.
Hitler just, it really, King Kong seemed to just summarize everything for Hitler.
he did have a sort of a taste for adventure stories, so not very sophisticated ones, although this one is more sophisticated than it might appear on the surface.
He liked westerns too, apparently, but
right, he did,
you know.
Yeah, his favorite author was Carl May, who was sort of a European Max Brand or Zane Grey.
Not interesting.
Yeah.
You know, my nephew once wrote, I mentioned earlier that King Kong, you know, his taste for King Kong perhaps redeemed him in a small way. My nephew once observed, he said, Hitler wasn't all bad. After all, he killed Hitler.
There you go. Put an end to the greatest threat to world peace on Earth at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
They got a guy in that, huh?
It was, thanks, you know, thank you for that.
I once gave a series of talks at a Christian music venue festival that was held every year. They, in addition to music, they had, tracks of lecturers and to talk about culture subjects and stuff. And one of the things I got called on to talk about from time to time was film and fantasy stories and things of that type. And I did a series called King Kong Died for Your Sins.
Oh, okay.
To a largely evangelical audience, that was a pretty edgy title. Uh-huh. But the idea behind it was that I had once seen a guy at a science fiction convention wearing a T-shirt that said King Kong Died for Your Sins, but it had a still from the movie printed on it, where if you'll remember, Kong, when he's been captured and brought low and brought in chains, dragged in chains to New York City, he gets put on display in the theater. And when you see him on display, well, you probably remember what he looks like, right?
Yep.
He's essentially crucified. He's tied to a big steel cross with his arms outstretched. And so a combination of that still and the title King Kong Died for Your Sins. I mean, once you see the connection, it's pretty hard to deny. And you think, well, is somebody just mocking it or what? You know, I mean, it exists. There it is. What? Where does that come from? And it was my kind of exploring and rooting around in all of that to try to get to the bottom of, is Kong a Christ figure? In what sense is he a Christ figure? And if he is a Christ figure, what does he say about Christ? And that led me to an exploration of Christ figures in other movies, too, E.T. and Day the Earth Stood Still and all that sort of thing. And it turned out to be a pretty profitable chain of thought, but yeah. You're not too far from the answer on Kong, how Kong is a Christ figure when you hear what Denham says about him in his speech when he brings him, when he shows him on the cross.
He was a king and a god.
In the world he knew, but now he comes to you merely a captive, merely a show to gratify your curiosity.
Yeah.
And then earlier on in the film, he says, that Kong was safe on his mountaintop where a whole army couldn't get him. But we've got something he wants. We've got the you know,
the girl.
The girl that he's smitten with, you know. Yes. And the idea of a god who's naturally, by nature,
impassable,
omnipotent, inconquerable.
Yeah.
The idea that he's made vulnerable, he comes down out of his safe heaven.
Yeah.
Out of love and becomes vulnerable, becomes something that can suffer and die, is a powerful image, and it's in the movie. And another scene, Denham says the beast was a tough guy too. He could lick the world, but then he forgot his wisdom. He fell in love and forgot his wisdom, and the little fellas licked him.
We will be right back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. We're here today with Rod Bennett, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
The Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4, and we are moving on with Lent, and we are moving on. I'm watching, you know, just the amazing spectacle. Somebody sent me an article today from the increasingly misnamed LifeSite News, which I have simply taken to calling LieSite News, because literally every time somebody sends me something from LifeSite News and I go and check it out, and it always turns out to be either obstinately wrong or just so sloppily written or researched that it just falls apart. But they've got life in the name, and that means that they're good, and you can never question them, or else you want to kill babies. Mm-hmm. And you know, they have suffered such massive mission creep. It used to be, apparently, some years ago, it was actually about, pro-life stuff. But, I mean, it's become, in the last few years, it's become every dumb culture war thing winds up on LifeSite News. You know, so these are the guys that promoted the idea that Pope Benedict had condemned Harry Potter books. And that one, you know, made it onto the Drudge Report and then went around the world and everybody, you know. So all it really was just the guys that write for LifeSite News don't like Harry Potter. So they decided to torque, you know, a couple of notes that Benedict wrote to some author. There's some German author that wrote him saying, I have this book on Harry Potter. And he was like, okay, the guy you want to talk to is this guy. Good luck. You know, and they managed to turn these minor little notes into, you know, the Pope condemns Harry Potter. And it's just gotten worse from there. And so today, you know, well, for the ever since Pope Francis was elected, really, these guys have just had it in for him. They just despise Pope Francis and they're constantly attacking him. And they will believe any crazy thing that anybody says as long as it attacks Pope Francis. So today there was some piece of rumor mongering on LifeSite News that was quoting a cardinal, you know, who's supposedly saying that whenever you get these kinds of quotes, there was, you know, it's like there are some who say, well, you can find some who say anything, right? The aliens killed JFK. There are those who say the aliens
sometimes
killed
JFK. Sometimes
you
don't even have to find the ones who say it. You just have to imagine that they must exist somewhere.
Yes.
Then you can say that there are those who say when it's there really are you those saying.
And so, you know, they quoted this Cardinal Negri saying, there are those in the United States who are asking Donald Trump to investigate the claim, which again, anyone can make a claim about anything. The aliens killed JFK. We should investigate. We should ask Donald Trump to investigate whether the aliens killed JFK. And so there are those who say that Obama pressured Benedict to resign. Now, there is zero evidence that Obama pressured Pope Benedict to resign. And Benedict himself has said repeatedly, I'm doing this of my own free will. And yet...
Well, they might be making him say that, Mark.
Oh, you're right. Yes. There are those who say that the extraterrestrials are making him say that.
And, oh, you mean like mind control or something?
Sure. Yes.
Well,
and
my
there
point
are,
was that a lot of people say, well, he has to say that. They've got something on him. Wait a minute.
Right.
The whole reason you prefer the guy is that he's a saint and Francis is evil, right?
Right. Well,
if he's a saint, he's not going to submit to pressure like that.
Right.
You know, popes have died for the truth before now, you know. If he's this saintly character that you think he is, then he can't be made not to tell the truth.
Well,
can't
you know,
be made to lie to the church about why he resigned, you know.
It goes back to the weirdness of this subculture that manages to convince itself of all these contradictory things just in order to maintain a narrative. You know, and the narrative
well, very
is,
much tied up with the conspiracy theory mindset of which the president suffers.
Yeah.
In other words, that you if you find somebody that this radical idea that you should can't trust the news. Well, I understand that news outlets have their biases. We all have them, okay? I can understand somebody saying CNN has a pro-abortion bias, for example. After all, CNN once, Ted Turner, who owned it, once forced them to run a documentary called Abortion for Survival.
Right.
So not exactly both sides of the story there, you know.
Yeah.
But so I understand that CNN has a bias. What I don't understand is these people who can't see that Fox News has equally as strong a bias.
Right.
In other words,
worse.
I see both things. How come you can only see one of them?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And LifeSite, you know, I mean, just regularly does this kind of stuff. I mean, they will print any crazy rumor. But, you know, in particular, what just amazes me is the notion that only Donald Trump can save the church from the evil that is Pope Francis. And it's talk about screwed up priorities, you know.
That's really, really strange and weird. But
it
I guess
is.
We shouldn't be too surprised. We've got people have run to the emperor before now against the Pope. And that's another example. This would just be another example of it.
Yeah. And you know, the idea that this emperor cares and is some kind of, you know, exemplary, you know, I mean, he just got granted, you know, some license from the Chinese government to run an escort service now in China. You know, these are the people that LifeSite News looks to and says, you know, this is the saintly hero that's going to save the church. And we always get this, you know, well, David was a sinner too. Well, yeah, but you know, the thing about David was he repented.
Right.
And this is a guy who says, I have no reason to ask. Right. And so you get this kind of stuff. And it just amazes me to watch Catholics twist themselves into pretzels like this. And for what? You know, I had somebody tell me yesterday, I am not making this up. I remarked that I thought that, here's a controversial statement, I think that Pope Francis is a decent human being. This doesn't seem controversial to me. This woman shot back at me. He is a nasty man. And then she said, I don't hate him, but I do think that he is trying to reduce the church to a spiritual North Korea. And I'm like,
whatever that means.
Well, I'm like, you know, okay, if that's like him, what, how would you talk if you hated him? You know,
with friends like you, he doesn't need enemies.
I'm kidding. You know, I mean this in the nicest way possible. You remind me of a psychopathic dictator who has starved his people to death. You know, so I don't know. I watch this spectacle unfold and I just keep thinking this just can't be sustainable. It can't be sustainable forever. This kind of, it's like a fever has gripped American conservative Catholics and they've just lost their minds.
The crosses over into evangelicalism also, of course.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I saw
American Christianity in general.
Yeah. I saw an article today. Apparently, the Southern Baptist Leadership Conference is now looking at going after Russell Moore, who is, one of the noblest prophetic voices in American evangelicalism. I have huge respect for Russell Moore. So who did the Southern Baptist Leadership Conference decide to go attack? Well, of course, Russell Moore, because he's questioned the dear leader. And it's, you know, it's like, don't you have some other priorities to worry about than this, you know? Yeah, so I don't know. It just boggles my mind, this madness that has gripped American conservative Christianity. They're just out of their minds. So I'm hoping that, you know, one day, hopefully it won't be after, you know, there's been some widespread nuclear exchange in which millions have died. American Christians will, I don't know, just wake up one morning and just go,
What on earth were we thinking?
Did somebody put something in my drink? I don't even know what happened, you know? But, it's just, I don't know. It's just amazing. I think,
I'm constantly being told, when I bring these things up, I'm constantly being told that I only say this because I'm a liberal. I'm not a liberal. Whatever that means.
I know.
How did you get the idea that I'm a liberal?
Well, because you're... It's
because I wouldn't say these things about the dear leader if I wasn't a liberal, right? Ipso facto.
That's exactly.
You say anti-Trump stuff, you become a liberal.
A liberal, yes, you know. Yes, why do you want to kill all the babies, Rod? Why? Anyway, we're out of time, but we've had a jolly time talking with Rod Bennett, as we always do. And I want to thank Danny Head, our producer, for producing today. We will be back tomorrow with Mr. Douglas O'Brien. Until then, have a lovely evening. Bye-bye.
for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.